Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. I'm Dave Marshall.
And I'm Liz Martin Silverstone, and you're listening to episode 109, Early Tetrapod Feeding Mechanics.
But before we give this interview 100% of our concentration, we're happy to announce that our PaleoCast Art Competition 2020 is now up and running. And this year we've teamed up with the good people at Studio 252 MYA, and winners of the competition will each be getting gift vouchers to their store at 252MYA.com so they can choose their own perfect paleo prize. So Liz, what would you get if you won?
I am really struggling to pick just one thing, but perhaps surprisingly, something that I really like is the Cephalopods poster by France Anthony. I think it's really cool, really colorful. And maybe a little bit more typically, I also quite like the cute pterosaur t-shirt, of course. What about you?
We haven't discussed this yet. You can't choose a squid poster because I've chosen a squid poster. The Birth of Squid poster. You need to go and see it. It's absolutely fantastic. And I would get it as printed as big as they possibly did. Hang it in the bathroom. It'd be the classiest room in the house.
What? So I'm not allowed to have a cephalopod
thing? You got to choose something else.
Too bad. I'm going out of the box on this one. So. As well as the store credit, we've also got some of the latest Paleo bestsellers to give away, each signed by their respective authors. For those of you who have taken part in the past, we're working with the same rules as our last competition, and for everyone else, you can find all the rules explained in detail on our website.
So simply put, you've got until the end of May to create a brand new piece of paleo art from scratch. This could be a drawing, it could be a sculpture, it could even be a song. Basically, wherever paleontology and art intersect. So whatever you do end up making, please email it through to info@paleocast.com and we'll upload it to our social media channels. Then it's up to the public to vote for whichever pieces they want to win by liking or favoriting each image. Please feel free to like as many entries as you want and share images to help them get more exposure. All votes will be counted until midnight on the 31st of May and the winners announced shortly thereafter.
So please do make sure you follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram and be ready to follow #PaleoCastArt to see every entry. This competition is a celebration of paleo art and is designed to provide a level playing field where effort is rewarded. So in this case, a crayon drawing of a pterosaur has just as much of a chance of winning as a beautiful landscape paleo art piece. We really hope that this competition will be the perfect coronavirus activity for any of our listeners, both young and old.
And so finally, onto this episode. Liz, please can you tell us about who you're interviewing and why?
Yeah, so this interview came about after the sad news of the passing of Professor Jenny Clack. We all know in the community how important Jenny was in the field of early tetrapods, and she's someone that we always wanted to get onto the show, but never managed to get it organized. So I thought this would be a good way of talking to some of her extended research community about their work and also how she inspired them and was still involved in the research going on today. So for this, I decided to interview Dr. Laura Porro from the University College London about her work on specifically feeding mechanics and biomechanics of early tetrapods. I've wanted to talk to Laura for a while now, and it just seemed like a good time to talk about her work and how Jenny inspired her.
So in the next episode, we're also going to be talking to some other researchers about the influence Jenny has had on their research careers. So if you want to hear that, please make sure that you're following us across all of our social media platforms, and we hope you enjoy this episode.
Thank you for joining me today, Laura. Can you start out by telling me how you got to your current position and how you ended up doing what you're doing now?
All right. Well, first of all, thank you very much, Liz, for the invitation. It's a bit of a long story, so feel free to stop me. So I start out by doing my undergraduate in the U.S. at the University of Illinois at Chicago. And I actually started out as an undergraduate in biological sciences. But the first year, I decided to take a course in geology just to do something different. And the lecturer was a paleontologist, and I ended up enjoying the course so much that the next year, I decided to take on a second major in earth sciences, which is one of the reasons my undergrad took so long. So then towards the end of my undergraduate, I was lucky enough to get a Gates Scholarship to come to the University of Cambridge, where I worked with Dr. Dave Norman. And there my thesis focused on biomechanics of the skulls of the earliest plant-eating dinosaurs. And that's where I really learned a lot of like the skills and the core methods that I'd need for my future projects. So once I finished my PhD, I had quite a few postdoc positions. So I worked on alligators and lizards at University of Chicago, and I worked on frogs at the Royal Vet College. But the research that's most relevant to what we're speaking about today started out as a Marie Curie fellowship that was based at the University of Bristol, working with Emily Rayfield, but also working very closely with Jenny Clack in Cambridge. And we looked at the evolution of the lower jaw across the fish tetrapod transition. So just to wrap everything up, after 10 years of postdocing, I finally got my first permanent academic position in 2018 at University College London.
Great. So you're now based at University College London as a lecturer?
Lecturer in anatomy. So yes.
Ah, cool. So it's not specifically a paleontology job.
It's not. No, I'm actually within the Department of Cell and Developmental Biology. So we mostly teach anatomy and human anatomy, but we also teach other courses within biosciences.
Very cool. So I guess that kind of leads well into my next question, which is, you know, you've spent a lot of time working on lots of different groups, as we've just heard, from dinosaurs to frogs and also early tetrapods. So can you tell me a bit about what got you interested in early tetrapods and why you've spent so much time working in that field?
Yeah. So definitely one of the perks of my field, which is biomechanics, is that you can use the same techniques across a broad taxonomic range and to look at very many questions, which I have done over the course of my career. But early tetrapods is definitely one group that I keep coming back to. And I think there's a couple of reasons for that. But really, they represent one of the most dramatic moments in the history of life. So it's this iconic image of vertebrates coming out of the water and onto land, and then subsequently evolving and diversifying to occupy all sorts of terrestrial niches. So we have herbivores and carnivores, we have animals that climb and burrow, animals that secondarily return to the water, and even some of the animals that you work on, aerial creatures such as pterosaurs, and also birds and bats that took to the air. This water-land transition, which we also call the fish tetrapod transition or the fin to limbs transition, it's not only a key moment in the history of life, it launches this huge terrestrial radiation.
How did Jenny come into this idea of you working on early tetrapods?
Okay, well, first of all, Jenny just had an enormous impact on paleontology in general, but on the field of early tetrapods specifically. First, she was a phenomenal field worker. So she very famously led expeditions to places like East Greenland and Scotland and made stunning new fossil discoveries that completely changed our picture of the earliest terrestrial vertebrates. She was also an expert in comparative anatomy and also developmental biology and functional morphology. So she revolutionized our understanding of many aspects of early tetrapods. And I remember, you know, reading some of the early textbooks when I was an undergrad, and she was overturning many of the long-standing ideas in the field. So for instance, one of the things that she was key in making us understand better was this fins to limb transition. So it was always assumed that these animals were walking around on land because they had limbs, animals like Acanthostega and Ichthyostega. And one of her very important discoveries was that actually these animals were still primarily aquatic. Initially, she proposed this based on various anatomical traits. And then later on, she worked with collaborators, for example, Stephanie Pierce, using biomechanical modeling methods that showed these limbs were not very good for moving around on land. So even though limbs eventually are very useful for moving on land, they evolved in water. Why did that happen? And it's something we're still trying to figure out. So that's just one aspect of our understanding of early tetrapods, that Jenny's contributions changed entirely. She also looked at things like sensory systems, their phylogenetic relationships, and their feeding, and so on. The other thing I would mention in terms of Jenny's impact on the field is just over the course of her career, she taught and trained so many students, undergrad, master's, and PhD students, and mentored many postdocs. And they then went on to make their own very crucial contribution to the field. So in terms of Jenny's impact in early tetrapods, she is one of the huge players, the huge legends in the field. And it was amazing to be able to work with her.
So you worked with her when you were at Cambridge, right?
I initially worked with her on a Marie Curie fellowship. I took her course as a PhD student and then ended up doing some undergraduate supervisions. And I remember the course was incredible because, especially in the labs, she would use the original fossil specimens of Acanthostega and Ichthyostega. And again, these were things I remember seeing in textbooks, and they were these sort of icons of evolution, like the original Archaeopteryx, and handle them, you know, and teach from them, you know, in the lab, which was incredible. And she's sort of very quietly, as it was Jenny, but very quietly enthusiastic about, you know, teaching the students in the lab. So that was my initial encounter with Jenny. And then we began talking after my PhD ended about potentially having a project looking at the evolution of lower jaws across the fish tetrapod transition. Over the course of a couple of years, and also with the input of Emily Rayfield, that project developed, and we eventually wrote it up as a Marie Curie fellowship.
That transitions very well into the next question, which I was going to ask you about, is lower jaws.
Okay.
So now that you've mentioned that, I guess a lot of what you had talked about previously was looking at the limbs and going like the fish to limb transition. But mostly what you've worked on is jaws and skulls. So how are lower jaws important? What can that actually tell us about early tetrapods?
Okay, well, as you said, and it's understandable why, most of the work on early tetrapods has classically looked at the limbs and the axial skeleton, because this is the you know, iconic transition. But if you think of animals moving out of the water onto land, many, many things need to change. And one of the less studied aspects of that is the skull and the lower jaws. Now, feeding is crucial to an organism's survival. And because of that, feeding exerts very strong selective pressure on animal shape and performance. The skull as a whole, yes, is adapted to feeding, but, and I can talk a little bit more about this later if you'd like, the upper jaw is adapted to many other functions as well. So it has to house the brains and the eyes and so forth. In contrast, because it has sort of fewer jobs to do, you could say that the lower jaw, we assume its shape is very strongly adapted to feeding, more so than the upper jaw.
That's an interesting point that you make, that in terms of early tetrapods, most of the work is done on the limbs, because that's what we think about. If you're going from a fish in the water to a tetrapod on land, the first thing you think is, well, it has to grow limbs. But why do you think people have not really looked at the skull? I mean, in general, people tend to go for skulls. Like, if people are studying dinosaurs, most of the time, you know, they go straight for the skulls. So why is it that these skulls have been kind of more ignored than the rest of the body?
I think there's two responses to that. First of all, and I'm not in any way talking down to people who work on limbs. I work on limbs as well. Skulls are very complicated. And as I said, they perform many different functions. And during the water-land transition, a lot of those functions would have changed. So I'm particularly interested in feeding, but you think of everything a skull does. These animals went from breathing water to breathing air. They had to go from being hydrodynamically streamlined to, being able to support their weight on land, so the skull no longer had to necessarily be streamlined, all of their sensory systems would have changed. They would have had to adapt their vision, their sense of smell, their hearing. All of these are housed in the skull. So one reason is perhaps it is very challenging to work with skulls. I think a second reason, and this is something that both the earlier Marie Curie project and our ongoing project is, I think, beginning to shed a lot of new light on, is that for a long time, people assumed that the skulls of all early tetrapods were more or less the same. You know, mm-hmm. they were all these flat-headed animals. Their skulls would have looked very much like that of a giant salamander today. And so I think in a way it was ignored because they figured maybe there wasn't much in terms of functional diversity. There wasn't much of an interesting story going on with the skulls because you don't see, or at least they didn't think that you could see, such dramatic changes as what you see with the limbs.
That's interesting. Going back to the jaws, how does that then kind of tie into your study on lower jaws? Is there a lot of diversity and like functional diversity within the lower jaws of early tetrapods?
I think we're beginning to understand that there's a lot of unappreciated morphological diversity amongst the lower jaws. And that implies that there might be functional diversity as well as dietary potential diversity. I can talk more about diets if you'd like in a moment. We've only really just begun to test this using biomechanical modeling, but I can share some results of, for instance, some of the biomechanical modeling we've done of the lower jaw. So for instance, one thing we found is that across the water-land transition, when we load the skulls with the forces that they would encounter during biting, first of all, overall stresses tend generally to go down across the transition, which suggests that the shape of the jaw is becoming better adapted for biting, for resisting these sorts of feeding forces. One of the things I think is really interesting, I'm always very interested in sutures, which is the shape of the bones where they contact each other. And a particularly interesting change in suture shape happens at the front of the lower jaw. So where the right and left halves of the suture come together, that tends to get much more strong, strongly joined as we go through the transition. So in fish, that contact is often very loose, held together by soft tissue. And then across the fish tetrapod transition, the bones begin to interlock very firmly with each other. And what that allows, very crucially, is animals normally just bite on one side of the skull. They do what we call unilateral biting. Now, if you have a fairly loose connection between your left and right jaws, not much of the muscle force from the non-biting side is going to get transferred over to the biting side. But as that connection between the right and left half of the jaws becomes stronger and stronger, we see more muscle force being transferred across and bite force begins to increase. And at the same time, the lower jaw seems to become remodeled to resist that bite force. So all of this suggests that as we move from water onto land, these animals are becoming better at biting, which makes sense. They have to move away from suction feeding and to biting. But it also suggests they may be getting better equipped, if you will, or better capable of tackling larger or harder prey.
If you can tell that the jaws are more resistant to biting and have these lower stresses, does that tell us what the animals were eating?
Well, so we assume, based on tooth shape, that most early tetrapods were carnivorous. Herbivory probably didn't appear until at least the mid-Carboniferous, if not later. So they were carnivorous. There is some tantalizing evidence, I don't think I can talk too much about it at this point, of some of the earliest tetrapods perhaps being what we call hard object feeders, but I'll leave that for the moment. But we can use some clues to hone in a little bit more precisely on diet. So, for example, if we think that a species is a suction feeder versus a biter. Animals that use suction to feed, the maximum prey size is limited by their maximum gape size. They can't actually consume animals any larger than their maximum gape size. Then we've got some early tetrapods. So an example is Crassegerinus that has these big, robust teeth and lots of space for jaw-closing muscles. So we can think that perhaps this enabled them to eat larger or perhaps even armored prey. They had big bite forces in the teeth to get through it. Whereas if you have a taxon that has really slender needle-shaped teeth, that's often associated with eating fish or soft-bodied animals like cephalopods. So there are some clues to their potential, to their more specific diet from their anatomy.
Interesting. Can you... I think this is more of a general question than specifically with early tetrapods, but like how kind of specific can you get to what they were eating? Is it just as simple as hard versus soft, or can you, like, is there any other evidence? I mean, this is a bit outside of your research.
I mean, but... if you're fortunate enough, sort of the smoking gun is if you find gut contents.
Sure.
I'm not too aware with especially some of the sort of classic early Devonian tetrapods, things like Acanthostega and Ichthyostega, that we have that. I think there are some gut contents, which are other fish for things like Eustenopteron. Most of the time, we don't have that. There might be some additional evidence. Tooth wear, for instance, tooth microwear. Animals that eat hard versus soft foods have very different tooth microwear. The eating of hard foods often produces these very distinct pits in the teeth. And then, of course, if you consume plants, which, as I said, we don't think that most of these very early tetrapods or any of these early tetrapods did consume plants. But if you were to consume plants, that leaves very distinct scratches on the tooth surface. So there are other lines of evidence. And then, of course, if you have some clues to an animal's potential diet. So for instance, it's a suction feeder. It can't eat animals over a certain size. You can look at what other animals inhabited the environment. Yes. Say, okay, this type of fish, for instance, may have been the potential prey of this animal, essentially because it would fit in its mouth.
Yeah. I was just thinking, looking back at this time period, obviously these are the first vertebrates moving onto land. So in terms of what they were eating, that's going to be pretty limited by the fact that there wasn't a whole lot on land. So they're either going
to... There was basically down to if they are actually feeding on land, and probably things like Acanthostega and Ichthyostega were not. They were almost certainly... Yeah. Primarily, if not entirely, aquatic. But then when you get a little bit later on, then yes, you're quite right. You're basically down to different kinds of arthropods or insects or smaller tetrapods.
Yeah, that was something I hadn't really thought about before, but I just thought, wait a minute. If they're the first things on land or the first vertebrates, then they're going to be eating insects.
And as an aside, this is one of the reasons why... many people are very interested in finding sort of the first instance of herbivory amongst terrestrial vertebrates. Because if you think about it, that's a huge, and at this point, apart from insects, untapped food resource that was on land and nothing was touching. So that I think was when you trigger a major radiation in different morphologies and function, is when things do become herbivorous. Because this now allows... much more complicated ecosystems to evolve.
Sure. Just because I'm not sure we've actually said this yet, but what kind of time frame are we looking at for this transition?
Okay. First of all, I should say that when we say a tetrapod, perhaps we should have gotten this at the very beginning.
Yeah.
We're talking about a vertebrate with four limbs, or one that evolved from something that initially had four limbs. So snakes, for instance, are tetrapods. So yes, in terms of living animals, amphibians, reptiles, mammals, and birds are all tetrapods. The earliest tetrapods, we first see it in the late Devonian. It's about 390 million years ago. We get what are called tetrapodomorph fish. So these are animals like Eustenopteron that superficially look very fish-like, but they have basic limb skeletons within their fins, their pectoral and their pelvic fins. By the latest Devonian, about 360 million years ago, you start to get these iconic animals like Acanthostega and Ichthyostega that have very distinct limbs with digits. Again, probably primarily, if not entirely, aquatic. And sort of the final stage in these earliest tetrapods is by the early Carboniferous, you begin to get animals such as pedipedes, which are your first truly terrestrial vertebrates.
Okay, so the first completely, definitely terrestrial, no aquatic kind of connection is Carboniferous.
Earliest Carboniferous, if you depend on body fossils, and this is where some quite controversial trackways come in, because there are what appear to be terrestrial vertebrate trackways that date from quite a bit earlier, from into the Devonian. But no conclusive body fossils have been found for the sorts of animals that were producing those trackways. And there is a lot of debate about whether some of these are even trackways, whether they were actually made on dry land versus sort of a shallow water lagoon kind of environment. So uncontested earliest Carboniferous, but there would be some people who would say that there must have been something happening earlier on land.
Where do these fossils come from, both the foot, like the trackways and the actual body fossils?
So many of the body fossils are actually from the Northern Hemisphere. Things like Eustenopteron come from Canada. Tiktaalik, another very famous early tetrapod, comes from Canada as well. Many of the fossils that Jenny worked with, so Acanthostega, Ichthyostega, came from East Greenland. And then a little bit later, like into the early Carboniferous, we get a lot of fossils coming from Scotland, as well as from a couple parts of the U.S., things like Rearupetan, for example. So many of them seem to be coming from the Northern Hemisphere. We don't get a lot of the early tetrapods. In fact, I'm trying to think of any coming from the Southern Hemisphere. And apart from tetrapodomorph fish such as Goganesus, we really don't get any in the Southern Hemisphere, which is interesting. Now, remember, of course, at the time, these continents would have been in very different locations. So many of them would have been what we call equatorial, paleo-equatorial at the time. Now, in terms of trackways, I think the most famous ones come from Ireland, but there's also some that come from Australia. So, yes, and again, that would change the picture quite dramatically.
That's really interesting. I didn't really realize that they're all, like, body fossil-wise, that they're pretty much all Northern Hemisphere, which is...
But again, as I said, you have to think actually of where those localities were 390 million years ago.
Sure. Yeah. I guess, yeah, probably should have done that at the beginning, but that's okay. Now we can get back into what your actual research is. So I think we have talked quite a bit about the lower jaws, but now more recently you've kind of moved into looking at the rest of the skull and looking at the upper jaws and also the cranium just generally.
Yes.
Can you talk, I know that this is a project in progress, obviously, because I'm also involved in it. but can you tell us a little bit about how the skull shape changed over the water to land transition?
So quite dramatically. And I think this is one of these things that there's been a lot of underappreciated diversity in the shape of the skull. So first of all, a few general trends. Which is that as these animals moved out of the water and onto land, we see a reduction in the total number of bones. So in some of the earliest tetrapods, things like Eustenopteron, you can have 50, even 60 bones in the skull. And by the time we get to the far side of that transition, you know, it drops to a few dozen. So a huge decrease in the number of skull bones. Changes in the way that those bones meet each other at the sutures, so the suture shape. Very dramatic changes in the size and the arrangement of the teeth. And this is true in the lower jaws as well. So many of the earliest tetrapods, they featured very small and very numerous teeth what we call the marginal transition, which, by the way, that's homologous to our teeth. They were teeth on the maxilla and on the dentary. So these teeth were really small, very, very numerous, and they all looked the same. And instead, they would have an inner row of teeth. So in the upper jaw, those teeth were on the palate, and on the lower jaw, they came off a series of bone called the coronoids. But this inner row of teeth that often featured enormous fangs. And one thing we see as we go along the transition is that inner row of teeth diminishes and eventually disappears completely. And instead, the outer row of teeth, the teeth become less numerous, but they also become larger. And you begin to get subtle variations along the tooth row. Nothing along the lines of what we see in mammals, but more what we see in modern crocodilians, where you get sort of waves of larger and smaller teeth, which suggests that this outer row is becoming more important for feeding. And then finally, we get less clear trends in terms of overall skull shape. So you get things like Eustenopteron, like these very early tetrapodomorph fish that are very streamlined, almost have torpedo-shaped heads. Then you go to things like Tiktaalik and Elpistostege with very flat skulls. It's not the result of deformation. They genuinely had very flat skulls. Then the skulls sort of become a little bit taller and more crocodile-like in things like Acanthostege and Ichthyostege. And finally, when you move into the Carboniferous, you start to see a lot more diversity in skull shape. So bit too detailed, perhaps, but these are sort of a review of some of the changes that we see in terms of shape.
No, it's interesting. And you brought up a point which I wanted to ask about, is this kind of deformation question. So you said, you know, some of them have these very flat skulls that's not deformation. I guess there's two questions in there. One is, what is the preservation typically like with these kind of things? And how do you deal with deformation when you have it?
Okay. The deformation we see is quite variable. So occasionally you get skulls that are beautifully preserved. Eustenopteron is one example. There are several very well-preserved, complete three-dimensional skulls. A lot of it has to do with the kind of rock, the kind of matrix that they're preserved in. So harder rocks, such as limestone, tend to deform less, whereas unfortunately, if an animal is preserved in mud or siltstone, you tend to get more deformation in the fossil. But as I said, there's some specimens that are very well preserved. Another one of the taxa that we're working on is an animal called Ledecarina, a much later tetrapod from South Africa that had a beautifully preserved skull. You get intermediate skulls in terms of preservation. So Acanthostege was an example of that. There was some deformation, but it wasn't too bad. And we got most of the bones of the skull from just two specimens. So we didn't have to look at lots and lots of other specimens. Then at the sort of extreme end of the spectrum, you get what we sometimes call paleontological roadkill. And I think that you worked on one of these taxa yourself. So things like Eoerpeton that are crushed completely flat. Bones are disarticulated. So how do we deal with deformation of that level? There's two types of deformation. First, you get what we get just breakage and bones becoming disarticulated. That's a little bit easier to deal with because when we CT scan the fossil and then we can separate out regions of interest, which is called segmentation, we can pull out individual bones and then we can rearrange them in 3D space to sort of piece the skull back together like a three-dimensional puzzle. And the nice thing about early tetrapods, I should mention, compared to some later vertebrates like dinosaurs, is that they often have these big overlapping contacts between the bones, these big overlapping sutures, which are really useful as guides to put this puzzle back together. The second kind of deformation, which is a much more tricky kind to deal with, is what we call plastic deformation. And that means that a bone or a part of the specimen, like the skull, hasn't broken, but instead it's been bent, it's been warped. That's a little bit trickier to deal with and often a bit more subjective. You often have to look at closely related taxa or do, for example, I use landmarks to help to sort of bend those bones back into shape.
I guess, I mean, this is kind of a what's the word? This is maybe a tricky question, and obviously it's a little bit subjective in a way, but when you're dealing with animals that are so old and in many ways so different from anything that we have today, how do you go about fixing the skulls and, you know, putting them back together and being confident that what you're doing and then putting into a biomechanical analysis is actually related to what it would have looked like?
No, that's quite a fair question. And you're right. People who work on more modern animals, so for instance, a lot of work goes into reconstructing the skulls of fossil hominoids. They can often use extant human skulls as a template, sort of to piece those bones together. And I'll come back to that right at the end. We don't have that luxury with early tetrapods. We don't have anything that's particularly closely related to them alive today. And even things that you could say are their closest relatives, like lungfish, they've developed on their own evolutionary trajectory for the past 300 million years, so they look very different. So often what it comes down to is detailed knowledge of anatomy. So again, knowing, you know, how the bones fit together, recognizing these sutural contacts and realizing this has to overlap by that much. And you do, and this is one thing I should note that has limited the number of samples and the number of taxa in our studies, is that we don't try to reconstruct the sort of most deformed, most broken up, and least complete specimens for that very reason. And then the other thing is, you can, but you have to be careful, try to compare animals that are less well-preserved, like Eoerpeton, to those that are a little bit better preserved, such as Greererpeton or Acanthastega, the ones that you do have better material for. Now, I'll just end with one, as I said, with one point, which is one of the disadvantages of what we do is that we don't really have any taxa that we can use as a template for reconstructing these things. But there's a danger to using templates as well, which is that you often feel the need to try and fit your broken, deformed fossil specimen into a known shape. And I think that that can be quite dangerous because you just assume that everything looks alike and just try and cram it into a mold, so to speak, whereas there might be more morphological and therefore functional diversity in that.
That's an interesting point. You can definitely see that you might kind of pigeonhole yourself into a certain idea if you have a shape already that maybe isn't actually accurate.
And we know that, you know, for instance, many groups that we think have very sort of homogeneous shapes today, like crocodilians, in the past had much more diverse morphology. So if we didn't have well-preserved fossil crocodilian specimens, we'd be trying to get all fossil crocodiles to sort of look like modern crocodiles, and we'd miss the point that at one instance in time, there was a lot more diversity.
Yeah, I guess there is, to a certain extent, some things that you can learn from modern animals. Like in your current study, you are looking at some living animals as well. Can you talk just a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. We always depend on living animals for these sorts of studies. One of the main reasons for specifically what I do is that because we're going to be doing a lot of biomechanical modeling, we need to model the soft tissues. And soft tissues are very rarely preserved and never preserved in animals this old, in fossil animals this old. So our only evidence, really, apart from muscle scars on the bone, is looking at their living relatives. Now, again, those living relatives are not tremendously closely related. It's a big phylogenetic extant bracket. It is crucial to what we do. And so, for instance, with the early tetrapods, one thing we do know is that if we look at animals on one side of the bracket, so basal ray fin fish and lungfish, and then animals on the other side like salamanders, is there was a dramatic rearrangement of the cranial musculature across that time, which is not surprising. These animals are, you know, they're moving out of water onto land, they're moving from suction feeding to biting, from breathing water to breathing air. So that's not surprising. And so we use evidence from either end of the spectrum and then sort of work towards that middle and also consider evidence from the fossil in the form of muscle scars, in the form of processes that we know that muscles attach to, and use that to reconstruct the sort of missing pieces, the soft tissue in this case, within the fossil taxa. But no, extant animals are very important to our studies.
And you can get enough information, even though they are quite, I was going to say not closely related, you know, they're like, what's the right word? Distantly related?
Yeah, well, the thing you have to remember is that although they may have, they are closely related, and they may once have, you know, in terms of morphology and function, been much nearer to early tetrapods, they haven't sort of stayed still for the last 300 million years. Sure. They've been evolving themselves. So that's just one thing to consider. But yes, even though they've been on their own evolutionary trajectory, even though they're very different from early tetrapods, they do help to bracket. They kind of, in some ways, sort of provide sort of the ends of a spectrum that we work within.
That's really interesting. I guess we can kind of wrap up and come back to the original sort of idea for this episode. We've talked a lot about the lower jaws and the skull, but can you talk a little bit about how all of this work kind of followed on from what Jenny started so many years ago, and what role she played in our understanding of how the skull evolved?
Well, first, and as I said before, it was the specimens that Jenny uncovered during her field work, and then later during her sort of comparative anatomical studies, that reshaped completely our understanding of early tetrapod anatomy and evolution. And there is no way to sort of overstate or exaggerate the importance of those fossil discoveries. But also because she was just such a great anatomist, it was Jenny that first noted many of the anatomical trends that I've been talking about. So it was her that noted these changes in the dentition and was writing about them back in about 1998. She wrote a big comparative paper on the changes in the dentition, the reduction and the changes in the arrangement of the bones. She first noted, particularly in the lower jaw, that there must have been a rearrangement in the orientation of the jaw muscles because of where the attachment sites moved to and also the orientation of the jaw joints, and speculated on what this meant for performance and diet. And as far as I know, she was one of the first people to suggest that changes in suture shapes in these animals, and some work has been done subsequent to this that Jenny was an author on as well, the changes in suture shapes are related to changes in load regimes and therefore potentially to feeding mechanisms and diet. So Jenny not only provided much of the fossil material that our current work is based on, she set up many of the kind of ideas and hypotheses that we now have the analytical techniques to actually test.
That's really amazing that you can still kind of work from her hypotheses and move forward with it.
And there are so many, and you know, this certainly the current project will not cover them all. There still will be a lot to do in the future.
So no end in sight for the early tetrapod research.
And that's not a bad thing. I don't think that's a bad thing at all.
Well, I think that's great. I think that's pretty much everything that I had to ask. Do you have anything you want to end with, or any final thoughts?
Jenny was a wonderful. She started out as a teacher and a mentor, and later on became a very close collaborator and a friend. And she will be very much missed by many people. But I think we can all take comfort in the fact that her legacy, as I said, through her students, through her postdocs, through the body of work that she accumulated over 4 or 5 decades, will carry on for a very long time. So.
That's
There's
great.
A silver lining there.
Yeah, no, that's great. Thank you very much for talking with me, Laura.
All right, thank you very much again for the invitation.
Paleocast was brought to you by Dave Marshall and Liz Martin Silverstone, with contributions from Tom Fletcher, Vish Venkat, and Elsa Pancharoli. Music was composed by Patrick Kendall Smith. Paleocast was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, but the show now relies on funding from you, the listeners. So, if you've liked this episode, please consider donating, and thanks to everyone that's helped out so far. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material to this episode and for our archive of past programs, and follow us across social media platforms to get all the latest news. Finally, if you enjoy our podcast, then please explore all of our video content on YouTube and follow our other projects, the Virtual Natural History Museum and the Paleocast Gaming Network.